Once, as a child, I walked past a field that exploded into a flight of red-winged blackbirds. And suddenly I knew that there are hidden worlds which might at any moment rise up into glorious view and just as suddenly fly away.
Blackbirds singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the line of a dark black night.
Lynn Ungar has a memory of a field that erupted with blackbirds. I have memories of being by a river and the leaves. They must have been aspen or poplar, I don't know, but I remember the way they looked as they turned in the wind and the sun caught them. I have no idea how old I was or where that was, but that is stuck with me. And perhaps you have memories from your childhood, moments of wonder in the natural world, perhaps a sight, perhaps a smell of the earth. Perhaps you have memories of sorrows, moments of deep sadness. Perhaps you have memories of learning some new fact about how the world works that just sort of opened up your mind in a different way. We join together as a community to share these moments with one another. And that's what I'm going to be talking about this morning. But first, I want to take you back in time to the beginning of the 20th century, about 100 years ago, to the time of the young adulthood of Sophia Lyon Foss, author of two of our readings this morning. It was a time of great excitement in Unitarianism, and also liberal religion generally, inspired by the pragmatic and progressive approaches to human nature put forward by people like William James and John Dewey, liberals were bringing religion into the modern age. Sophia Lyon Foss was a religious educator. She's most well known today as a curriculum writer, rather than a theologian, but in fact, she was both. She was a practical theologian who listened carefully to children. Writing closer to our own time in 1990 about Foss, Shirley Rank said, "Women today are often recognized for contributions which do not challenge basic patriarchal structures. Work with children is acceptable for women, as is the development of curricular materials for children, and even a philosophy of education for teachers and parents. But a sophisticated theology which challenges the whole biblical patriarchal worldview on the basis of 20th century science, however, is likely to be ignored, especially if it is written by someone whose main focus is children. This was the achievement of Sophia Lyon Foss. She herself said, "I would not say that my interest was primarily in method, or that it was not theological. Even in those beginning days of my teaching experiences, I felt keenly that the children's theological beliefs and mine were very much involved in what we were doing. Theology meant then, as it does now to me, a way of interpreting experience to meet one's personal need for a guiding philosophy." Foss described her theology as homemade. She had to struggle because theologians weren't, in her time, and perhaps now, weren't that interested in children's experiences and perspective. Her primary academic existence came from educators who were bringing a new understanding of the psychology of children, but who were not that sensitive to theological and belief issues. Today, as Unitarians, it's easy to overlook how groundbreaking Foss's work was. Her most influential book, Today's Children and Yesterday's Heritage, took the whole Bible and saw it through the lens of what science was saying about the world and about history. Today, in our congregations, that is totally unremarkable. But Foss was entering into a conversation with children about these things, in which both she and the children were providing content to the conversation. She watched how her own beliefs and what she was learning in academically were changed as a result of these conversations. She watched children grapple with the concepts and incorporate them into their own beliefs in unique ways. And she came to understand that each of us is our own primary theologian. We are responsible to ourselves for what we believe and how we act on what we believe. She wrote a curriculum based on this idea called the Beacon Curriculum. It invited teachers to take children's thoughts and ideas seriously, and her goal was to help the child become their own theologian. This is unremarkable to us today. It's an approach that's now found in every single Unitarian curriculum, from Toolbox of Faith for elementary school kids to Building Your Own Theology for adults. But at that time, it was a radical idea. At the time, people thought that children were vessels and that they were meant to be filled with what we were going to impart to them. And so this idea that we would listen and be in dialogue and in relationship was radical. Like many born in her era, so she was born in 1878, Foss grew up in a household with a commitment to evangelical Christianity. Her parents were missionaries, and that's what she herself wanted to do. However, in the process of getting her master's in education, she was exposed to new ideas about the psychology of children and also to new ideas about the Bible. She learned about historical criticism. She discovered that the Bible was a record of human experiences and a series of interpretations of experiences. And this reshaped her worldview. The Bible was one source among many that a child might use to make sense of their experiences. Jesus was a person who struggled with many of the problems that we face. How do we live a good life? How do we respond to poverty? And we might learn something from studying his approach. It was Foss who promoted the idea that young children need to learn about all religions, not just one. But most of all, she promoted the importance of children and youth in our fellowships. She said they are important not because of who they are going to become, whether you think that is good citizens or proponents of a particular way of being, they're important because of who they are right now. And this is the heart of the Unitarian understanding of lifespan learning. At each age, we are important for who we are right now. And each of us has projects that we are working on in our lives. We have gifts and we have challenges. We all have something to learn and we all have something to give. As human beings, we seek to make meaning out of our experiences, to understand ourselves and the world around us. Children hear much more than we expect. Their minds work differently than ours, and they put things together in ways that we would not. Sometimes they are looking for more information about how the world works. Sometimes they're looking to see how we understand things. And sometimes we need to let go of being in the driver's seat and learn from their openness, their sharp vision of what's happening around them, and their flexibility of thought. So yesterday, as many of you know, I had the privilege of spending 10.5 hours with 6 11 to 13-year-olds. Now, I realize that for some of you, those of you who are actively parenting, this is nothing to write home about. You do this every day. And perhaps for some of you whose children are long grown up, or like me, who never had children, or whose careers with children have come to a close, perhaps it is overly noteworthy. By which I mean, sometimes people say to me, "Oh my goodness, thank goodness you did that," as in, "Thank goodness I was not doing that." Well, when I first decided to become a minister, that was me, actually. I was worried that I wouldn't be able to do that, that I wouldn't be able to have a meaningful relationship with kids in the congregations that I served. Some ministers, some people seem to have this natural ability just to get right in there and instantly connect with kids, to be in their world. And I don't have that, actually. I never did, even as a child. I was more comfortable with adults than with other children. So I sought out field placements that would let me spend time with children and youth. And I was always especially anxious when those moments approached. And there was part of it that I was right about. It was not easy. Lessons that were planned failed, completely bombed. Ministers and supervisors sometimes wondered, well, what's wrong with her that she can't do this? It took a very kind director of religious education who explained to me, after watching to me and listening to my woes, that what the kids and the youth needed was for me to be me. They didn't want me to be trying to have with them the relationship that their beloved minister or DRE had with them. They wanted a relationship with me. And by the way, she said, that is probably what the adults want, too. They're just too polite to say anything. Kids will tell you this by their attention span. Adults will sit there and politely wish for something that was different and not say anything. Well, that was, in the moment, absolutely horrifying. And it was also freeing. Yes, it is important to study, to know what is developmentally appropriate, to understand theory, to have done lots of prep so you have several things in your back pocket when one thing plops. But the primary skill that we use in our congregations is learning to be present. It's about learning to be ourselves with another person who is a different age from us, whether it is somebody much younger than us or somebody much older than us. It's about learning to be present to ourselves so that we can respond authentically and without expectation of praise or comment, or in my case, good supervisor marks. Being present with a group of 11 to 13-year-olds means following thought patterns and physical movement patterns that are much faster than I'm used to. My brain doesn't work that way anymore, and my body doesn't quite work that way either. And that's okay. This is no different, really, than any other being with that I'm doing. I'm meant to be me. It's okay that I can't run quite that fast, that I'm worried about rolling over on my ankle. it's okay that I haven't followed that joke, that I can't figure out why that joke is funny. I can ask, or I can just smile and enjoy the sense of delight that they have in their words. The tween years, the 11 and 12-year-olds, is an age of huge transitions. One moment, they are laughing hysterically and extendedly about a series of jokes that really do make no sense to me. And maybe they don't make sense to them, I don't know. But then, seconds later, they're offering deep insight on a serious topic. Perhaps about loneliness. Perhaps about the rigidity of adult thought and behavior. This group yesterday analyzed the role of emotion in two movies, Inside Out and Divergent. And they played Grounders, a form of tag on the school playground. And they talked about what qualities they wanted to bring into their lives. And they spent even more time talking about what happens when you try to eat spaghetti and the table is on an angle. The moments of insight and reflection are brief, and if I'm not paying attention, I will miss them. Because they come between long bouts of having fun and playing games. But they are there, and they're important. And it may not look like, to the casual observer, that the games are important, but they are. The games and the humor are also part of the curriculum. Our Unitarian Youth Manual divides games into five types, depending on what stage of community you're building. They start at bonding games. They move on to opening up games, affirming games, stretching games, and deeper sharing games. Yesterday, because this was a new group, most of the games that we did fell into bonding and opening up. They were mostly non-competitive and collaborative. They helped break down barriers. Some of the kids only knew one or two people at the beginning of the day. But I think when Joanne arrived after lunch, it seemed like a fairly cohesive group had formed. They had shared jokes already and a shared story. Mid-morning, we created a group agreement about how we wanted to be together. Everyone took a turn naming the request that would help them have fun and feel safe having conversations. We had a conversation about each item, and you know, when I say conversation, I mean a couple words back and forth, about each item, and then we all signed it. Later in the day, when comments got a bit sharp, someone would say, "Is that respectful?" As respect was one of the things we listed. Or they would just say, "I don't like that word." And there would be a sense of pulling back as a group and processing. And another word might be replaced, like maybe it's better to call somebody a rotten egg than whatever was said. And the group decided that yes, rotten egg was respectful, because that's what you do as a group. You decide what your boundaries are. They made a commitment about how they wanted to be together, and they took that commitment seriously. As I said, we each have something to learn from each age, and perhaps as a community, we have something to learn from this group of 11, 12, and 13-year-olds. In the whole of our life experience, we don't get to cover everything that a human being can experience. If we imagine our lives as a vast prairie, we have our particular path through it. The things that we can see, and sometimes we can see far here. But always there are things beyond our vision. There's the dip in the ground that if we're not there right there, we will miss. We need one another. We need to know where everybody is standing so that we can learn what their particular path looks like. There are places we will never experience but through another person. We need one another to maintain a sense of what it means to be human. We need our 4-year-olds and our 5-year-olds. We need our 11 and 12-year-olds. We need our 45-year-olds, our 55-year-olds, our 65-year-olds, our 75-year-olds, our 85-year-olds, and if you have them, your 95-year-olds. We are each complemented by one another. We each have something to share and something to learn. May it be so for us. Amen. Blessed be. I invite you now to consider the age that you are at. Whether you think of it as a life stage or a decade, whether you think of it in relationship to the other people in your lives, what is it that you are experiencing right now? What is the life project that you are embarked on? What do you have to share with us about this place in your life, what it is like for you to be the age and stage that you are at right now? What would you like to learn from one another? So rather than opening the floor to a general congregational response, what I'd like to do is invite you to say something about the age or stage that you are at right now, what it means to you, what is the challenge or the gift, what would you like to learn, so that we can be a community in conversation with one another. Wayne has the microphone so that we can all hear you.
Thanks, Wayne. I'm Jane. I thought I'd start because I'm having a delightful time. I'd say this is the best time of my life in many ways, although I've enjoyed it all. But as a person who's retired just about 3 years now, I'm really paying attention to how I spend my time. And it's really fun because I'm learning about myself. What do I really care about? What's important to me? And figuring out how to balance all the things that are important to me and spend time on those.
I think sometimes we despair of youth as we look around, but if we look south of the border and look at Bernie Sanders and see how he's energized people, and it's almost like it's a mystery what has happened that people are waking up. And I think I mentioned last week that we need difficult conversations. I think we need to talk about what it is that the young people are waking up to. And last week we had a very good presentation where they were saying that our government is now doing a review of our defense needs, and who knows where it's going to go. But if we keep our mouths shut, we are not going to maybe have a very happy experience.
Joanne again. This follows from what Dave says, but in a personal way. Just, I've been reflecting a lot about learning to really listen to what people are saying and not be so quick to offer what I think is the correct way.
Let's see if I can remember this. I think I'm trying at this point to meet people where they're at more. Like, I'm trying to, I mean, I guess I'm in my 40s now, and I'm starting to come to the realization that some of the people I love are not going to live forever. And so my mom, although sometimes she's frustrated me in the past, I've realized I just need to start enjoying spending time with her. And so we've found things we enjoy doing together and have started focusing on those activities instead of on arguing or what we don't agree on. And she said something the other day that really struck me. My father and I were having a tiff because he's difficult to get along with. And I expressed my frustration to my mother later. And she said, you know, Heather, maybe he just doesn't know what to say. Maybe he's trying, and that's just what him trying looks like. And I was shocked to hear my mother say that. So I think we're all moving forward, and hopefully me somewhat slowly, and even my mom at this point. So.
Thank you, Karen. And I'm coming back to what you said about having dealing with small kids and so on. And I'm crazy enough, and but I always realize that most of the time we look at people from a distance instead of being from a close look. And one thing I usually do is sit at the level of the child, except I cannot sit on the floor. I've got some issues, physical issues, but it's always to be eye to eye. And it is an amazing feeling to realize, but basically, you're one of them at a different age.
As I mentioned last week, our son is going through a number of transitions and has, as a result, has been spending a lot of time with us. And I have really enjoyed the time that he's been with us in a because I haven't really had that opportunity for a long time. For example, we drove to Saskatoon and back because he had a job interview in Saskatoon, and I really enjoyed the whole of the trip because we were with him. And, you know, there was no alternative, for which I was glad, because it was just great to spend time with him.
Well, we'll just take the last two, I think, because time's moving on.
I've tried out several decades, quite a number of them actually, and played a lot of roles in life, some successful, a lot not. But I found finally that my role in life can be identified with my family, with helping them not give up on each other, with trying to share the things I've learned in a way that they can believe in the power of love for each other. And that's my job. I'd like it to be otherwise, but it's got its own rewards, I guess.
This summer I will have completed my 80th year. And my kids, every one of them, with spouses, my grandchildren with spouses or without, are coming on the July 1st weekend to help me celebrate my 80th year. But they've also said that it is a reunion. And to me, that's the more important thing than just marking a year. So we're going to have a reunion, and they are so important to me. They are my bedrock. And we have the typical family things going on. Relationships aren't always great. But I look at each of them and think, you're a human being I love. And I feel gratitude in this year.
Thank you. Sorry.
One of the things we did with the youth yesterday, it's a tradition in youth culture in Unitarianism that at a, when you have a conference or a retreat, you have mailboxes, which are usually brown paper bags, and everybody puts their name on it, and they're taped up on a wall. And, oh, there's Joanne's right there. Thank you, Joanne. Andrew has one, too. They were both with us yesterday. So adults and adult advisors and youth do this. And everyone is responsible over the course of the conference or the day for putting a note in every single mailbox. And with this age, because it was a new idea, we did it a little more explicitly. Some of our youth in this congregation who go to conferences know that it just sort of, you know, it happens. You want to do it. You notice things. But we were sitting down. I had a special table that when you had some free time, if you weren't the group that was doing the dishes after lunch, you could go and sit at the table and work on your notes to other people. And I sat down there at one point, and somebody said, "This is hard." And I thought, yeah, you know, it is hard. We're busy doing our lives and just paying attention to what's fun or whatever, and writing an affirming note means that we're actually looking at every single person in the room, in the group, and noticing things about them that make them unique. And it's not necessarily our habit, and it's not necessarily easy, but it's a habit of mind that we can train ourselves into, to notice what is going well and to thank people for it. And one of the things that really came through strongly with me, because you don't read your mailboxes during the event. You come, you take it home, and it's private to you, and you can share it with whomever you want if you wish, but there's no obligation. So I want to share with you how much it mattered to all, now I'm going to tear up, how much it mattered to all those kids, that adults from this congregation spent time with them. If you say you want to know what the kids want or what the youth want or why Bernie is so successful, he's listening to them. So I invite all of us to take our youth seriously and to listen to them, because they have a lot to say. They're going to say it in ways that are not necessarily how we might normally hear it. It might come out kind of bloop like that. It might be gone in 2 seconds, so you have to be attentive. But they are saying it. They know what they want. And what those kids wanted was community. And you can give it to them if you want. Amen. Blessed be.